With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. That is Nick Wright. Joining us this morning, we have Brian Westbrook and Eric Mangini. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. I apologize. Nice. I was a little late to the set this morning. I haven't even buttoned my jacket.
You were a little
good
late.
Good to see you. How are you?
Looking good, though.
Good to see you.
You're recovering from the
Jenna
parade,
Wolf.
I assume.
Nice to see you.
Recovering from what?
The parade. Is that why you're so tardy this morning?
It's cold there
something
yesterday.
Like that. Yeah, something like that.
Hard to get started.
Very cold in Kansas City yesterday.
We have a big show for you today. We have another cryptic hint from Tom Brady. To
can
break
this
down.
Guy get enough attention? Coach,
Coach loves that. Zion is hurt again. We'll talk about what that means for him. And we learned yesterday the Chiefs Snow had to throw one hell of a party.
Starts with a police chase.
That's it. But it ends with a down
Kansas
court
City
flight.
Type of party.
After a 50-year drought, the Kansas City faithful watched their beloved Chiefs make their way downtown in their long-awaited Super Bowl victory parade yesterday. With temperatures in the 20s, attendance close to a million, and a beer count we'd rather not divulge. There was only one way to cap off the festivities with a Travis Kelce speech for the ages.
21 years. Y'all know what that means? Everybody here is thinking, oh, that's when I can, you know what I mean, legally get a drink. Yeah. No, 21 years. That's how long it's just been turning for my guy Andy Reid. It's just been turning and turning and turning. And what we do, we unleash a can of whoop on everybody. 24-0, I ain't trying to hear it. Down 10, I ain't trying to hear it. Fourth quarter, 6 and whatever left on the clock. Down 10. We got Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid, baby.
I mean, come on, Travis runs in the family.
Absolutely.
Right?
Brother Jason had a great speech. Travis was awesome.
All right, Nick, parade and festivities and all of that aside, we obviously spin this forward. What do you think it'll take for the Chiefs to have sustained success with, as Kelce said, Reid and Mahomes, baby?
Yeah, well, I think it's about those two guys specifically almost more so than the rest of the team and organization cumulatively. And I want to start with a man near and dear to your heart and a guy that I know you were rooting for in Andy. Because I think it should be noted, not Super Bowl level success, but the Chiefs were having sustained success, the best prolonged tenure of sustained success in their franchise's history, before Patrick Mahomes ever took a snap. They, in the 5 years before Mahomes took over as a starter, they went to the playoffs 4 times. They won 9 games or more every single year. And in Andy's 7 years there, they have 77 wins. They have 1 year they didn't win double-digit games, and it was the 9-win season. 1 year they didn't make the playoffs. So, I mean, this has been a 12-win team 3 of the last 4 years. Only 2 of the last 4 has Patrick Mahomes been the quarterback there. So when we talk about the secret to New England, the first step is hire Bill Belichick. Second step is draft Tom Brady. The third step is make sure you did steps 1 and 2 and work backwards from there. The Chiefs have that. The Chiefs have, I think, the second best coach of his generation from the 2000s to now in Andy Reid, and the most talented quarterback I think any of us have ever seen. So to have sustained success, keep Andy Reid out of retirement, and keep Patrick Mahomes healthy, if you do that, you start the season, and I know Coach hates to hear this, you start the season at 10 wins. And the question is, can you get to 11, 12, 13 wins? But with that coach-quarterback combination, you should always be in the playoffs. You should always be in contention, and then see if you can go on a run similar to one the Chiefs just went on.
Anytime you have Andy Reid, who is a great scheme guy, a guy that's going to game plan very well, he's going to be detail-oriented, he's going to be prepared, and you have a quarterback that can execute, I think you're certainly going to be in discussion. That's that's what you just mentioned. Here's a couple of things that happened throughout the season that I think impacted them tremendously as far as in the playoffs and the Super Bowl. First of all, Patrick Mahomes got hurt, but he got hurt in the middle of the season. Because they were able to put that kneecap back in, he wasn't out very long. That helped that football team an awful lot. And when you talk about the injury bug, you also got to look at Chris Jones. He came back and was probably the most effective guy on that defense. Yep. And he came back at the exact right time. He was able to affect the divisional round. He was able to affect the AFC Championship game as well as the Super Bowl. His presence in the interior of that defensive line was great. The other thing, and you mentioned it, they have a weak division. I mean, that's just what it is. They have a weak division. They have a bunch of teams that don't have great quarterbacking, that don't have great teams prolonged success. I think that's important. That was important to the Patriots' success. And the other thing, that last two things, actually. If they want to continue the success of Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid, speed has to remain speed. And what that means is that the fast guys have to remain fast guys, because when Tyreek Hill slows down just a couple steps, he's just a small guy that's not as fast. That blazing speed changes the game. Sammy Watkins, blazing speed changes the game. And if they don't have that, it's a different type of team, different type of quarterback system there. And the last thing, and I think, Coach, you probably know this better than anyone else, they have to draft well. If they can draft well continuously, especially after they pay Patrick Mahomes, they have a chance of winning in the future. But if they don't draft well, there's been many teams that have great quarterbacks, but as soon as you pay your quarterback, you have to draft so well, because now you got to get your young players to play well. If they don't do that, then they don't have the chance to have that sustained success that everyone is looking forward to.
It's sustained success that everybody is just assuming is going to happen. And look at the situation in New Orleans. You have a really good quarterback. You have a really good head coach. And they were down years. They were up years where they didn't make it to the Super Bowl. And then they won one Super Bowl. And that's been a great combination for a long time. You look at Aaron Rodgers. He's on a new head coach. He's an outstanding quarterback. He had an outstanding head coach. You look at Peyton Manning, for some of his years where he had down years or didn't achieve at the highest level, didn't win the Super Bowl. And there's this assumption that just because you show up, things are going to work out. That's not how it works. And you know, as well as anybody, every single year you get faced with this new set of challenges. And there's the guys that have experienced the adversity and the success and know how to work and know how to do things. And then there's new guys that come into the culture and either they fit or they don't fit, and you hit different levels of adversity. And so to just be able to project out because of Patrick and Andy, should you have a great starting point? You should. How is Patrick going to respond to the money? How is he going to respond to the success? How are the other guys going to respond to that? You think everybody in that locker room is going to be content with their current contract after winning a Super Bowl? People want a taste of that success. They want a taste of those riches that come with that success. And there's a lot of selfishness that creeps in where to truly be successful on a sustained level, you need to be selfless. And this is inherently opposed to that because of everything that comes with winning the Super Bowl.
Well, I want to talk about those three quarterbacks you mentioned, because I think they're all in unique circumstances. There's Breeze, the only of the three who, during his prime, went through a period in the wilderness out of the playoffs repeatedly, three times, 7-9, with Drew Breeze in his prime.
Yeah, because you have to play defense and special teams.
Exactly,
like, that's
right.
Part of this
100%.
Game.
100%. That's the point I was going to make, is those Saints defenses, that was, to me, an organizational failure to not put any resources, seemingly, or at least competent resources, into the defense to where Breeze could have these 5,000-yard seasons and the team finish below 500. Rodgers, a slightly different circumstance. Rodgers made the playoffs every single healthy year of his career prior to last season, which ended with the coach being fired. They just had some heartbreaking playoff defeats. I think Manning...
But there was frustration there, too,
yes,
defensively and with free agency and with a lot of things organizationally.
Right, and that they didn't get over the hump, that they had, it was particularly that 2014 NFC Championship game when they should have made it to their second Super Bowl. And then the last one you mentioned is Peyton. I don't think Peyton had any lean years. There was the 1 year playoffs, Jim Mora.
Did he underachieve or overachieve?
Well, so that's what I was going to get to, was Peyton, throughout the regular season of his career, starting year four, he's in the playoffs with the Colts every single year until he has the neck surgery. But what is a fair critique of Peyton Manning, and we now have his entire history to look at, is his play markedly decreased, his play, in the postseason. And that was a Peyton Manning-centric team. One of the reasons I think
decrease against certain teams.
Well, okay, well, you guys in particular, but it wasn't just against the Patriots. No. He particularly struggled against you guys and what you guys were doing. But even in games not against the Patriots, you can look at it, and his passer rating dropped 30 points for his career in the regular season and the postseason. One of the reasons, Jenna, to be optimistic about the Chiefs is Mahomes' numbers have gone up across the board, limited sample, but in his 5 career playoff games, I don't think there's reason to believe he's the type of player who gets worse in the postseason.
You look at that Super Bowl and you're thinking that was an unbelievable.
No, I think that was his.
If anything, you should be concerned and disappointed based off of the first three and a half quarters.
Coach, what I think
you have to also look at the games, too. I mean, the first game of the season, the playoffs, they were down 24 points. Patrick Mahomes in that offense wasn't moving the ball consistently up and down the field.
Okay, listen.
I love the fact that he brought him back, but I think it's a problematic of where they put themselves in all three of their
games. Here's what I know. He's played 5 career playoff games. The Super Bowl absolutely was his worst game. And he won Super Bowl MVP because of it. He threw for 285 yards, 2 touchdowns, and scored 21 points in the final 6 minutes. Like, that's his worst of his 5 career playoff
games. The bottom line is, if it was easy to do what the Patriots were able to do the last 20 years, you'd have another team with all these great quarterbacks that you've mentioned, with these great coaches that we've mentioned, that would have been able to put years and years back-to-back together, and they haven't.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So, to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/FTF. netsuite.com/FTF. netsuite.com/FTF.
For the first time in 4 seasons, Tom Brady spent his Super Bowl Sunday watching the game and not playing the game. And while he did look rather spiffy in his 100-year NFL ceremonial burgundy blazer, he posted this yesterday: "I'm not wearing a blazer to next year's Super Bowl."
Tank top?
And when asked, probably not, when asked about his future on his Instagram Q&A, Brady's answer was this blank stare. A little bit of a shake right there. Nick, what do you make of all of Brady's social media activity? He seems to be having fun with the whole indecision.
Last month and next month, I'm all for fun. I'm the guy at the table who's always all for athletes having fun, expanding their brands, all these things. It is a little odd for Brady, though, to be engaging in this. It's not bad. This is not a value judgment. Okay, there is no positive or negative side of this. But it's a departure. It is different from the way he has traditionally conducted himself. When we've seen Tom draw attention to himself outside of just what he does on the field, it's almost always been related to either TB12, branding, or his family. And now it is more of the look at me stuff. And again, people think because I'm critical of how Brady played the last year and a half that I dislike Brady. I think Brady is the model pro athlete in America. He's been a consummate teammate. He's won at the highest of levels. He's done it through multiple systems. There's never been a bad headline about him. And I give him all the credit in the world for it. So this isn't a criticism, but it is an observation that it's different. That posting the Super Bowl commercial preview that we didn't know was a preview the Thursday night before the Super Bowl, where it hijacked that news cycle a bit. And now this Instagram Live, where are you going to be? And just the quizzical, I don't know what my answer is. Those are departures from the norm for Tom Brady.
But what's the norm for Tom Brady? Because he posts a lot, but what you said it's different. It's different from what? He's never gone through anything that's even been remotely close to anything controversial for him.
But the norm is he's in the Super Bowl. He's got a little more free time this time. The norm is he's in the Super Bowl. So, and from a social media perspective, he hasn't had time to really learn about it. And I can say this with kids now that are in high school and middle school, you want to be able to be part of their world. And Tom has a unique ability to be in those spaces, which I'm sure his kids find interesting, and it probably creates some sort of connection. I mean, my TikTok game is off the hook. But there's a relatability to that,
sure,
too. So I don't think we can say that it's a look at me, because there's nothing in his history where he's ever been a look at me type athlete. So I think it's more a function of some free time and probably relating to his kids.
You know, I don't think it's look at me, just like you mentioned, Coach, but I think the whole picture with him walking in or out of the stadium, that was all about the commercial. That was all about making a couple bucks with Hulu. So to me, that really didn't have much to do with Tom Brady as the brand or as the guy that we'd see on the football field. I think it was certainly a money play. It was a good decision by Hulu to make a commercial that made sense, and it plays on all of our heartstrings. We're all trying to figure out, what is Tom Brady going to do? What's his next step? The other part, this tweet that he did yesterday with the tweet live and trying to figure out where he goes next, to me, he didn't say anything. So it wasn't Tom Brady saying, this is what I'm going to do, or look at me. It was just, hey, I haven't made a decision. I also think it's putting a little bit of pressure on the Patriots to say, well, listen, which way do you want to go? And Tom Brady has the ability to say, listen, I'm not sure where I want to go yet, but I can certainly push the Patriot fans in the right direction to hopefully allow them to put pressure on the organization if there was ever such a thing that would help the organization make a decision.
And hasn't he, Nick, sort of earned the right to play around with this a little bit and have some this non-decision?
He's earned the right to do whatever he wants to do. But observing it honestly, he has not earned the right for us to lie about what's happening. Okay? And I'll push back a little bit with he's never been
lying about.
Well, to act as if Tom Brady going on Instagram Live, accepting the question and allowing up on the screen, where are you going to be next year, just so he can do that quizzical look. That is very unpatriot way-y of him. I don't care. It's not bad. And the idea that he's never been a look-at-me guy, I mean, Tom versus Time was a thing that happened during the regular season, a documentary being made on him and his life and his quest for, I don't even remember at this point, his fifth championship, his sixth championship,
he probably
whatever
wanted
it was.
To document the fact, I don't know if you know this, but there's a lot of people on shows that talk about how Tom is done. And at some point, they'll be right. At some point, they'll be right. And so for him to be able to document him overcoming something that nobody else has been able to do, I actually think there's value to that outside of whatever personal publicity he got. He was documenting something that other athletes had not been able to do.
Of course. And I thought it was a fascinating inside look, and I'm glad he did it. But it happened. It was I'm just curious. We got how many players in the NFL? 50, you call it 1,600 players?
Yeah.
I'm just curious. How many promoed, pimped their Super Bowl commercial a couple days before the game? There's one. And we got how many?
How many have six Super Bowl rings?
Okay, so again.
There's one.
Right, so you're making the argument that he has earned it. I'm making the argument.
And he pimped his Super Bowl. He did one picture.
Okay.
He did what he's supposed to do. That's what you're supposed to do if you're going to have a Super Bowl commercial that everyone's going to talk about. Absolutely. Here's the other thing about Tom Brady, though. Uh-huh. I mean, he certainly has deserved it. And there is life after the football. And I think that's what he's trying to set up at some point, the life after football, maybe with the social media posts and things like that. I just don't think there's anything wrong with what he's doing. He's not saying anything bad about the organization.
No.
He's not even saying anything about his decision. He's just saying, I haven't made a decision yet.
And it was one post. We're not talking about like 30 or 50 or every talk show or
no,
I mean,
and then
it was
then
one
it's
post.
An Instagram Live where it draws this conversation.
Nick, you've been a little hard on them. I mean,
no,
I think you've been a little
on,
hard
but
on
them. But he's not saying it. You
but
don't
but
have
again,
a
I think
with
you guys.
My mom has posted one time
but
Instagram.
You guys think I'm being hard on him because you guys are viewing it from the prism of a criticism. I would not have a problem if, for example, a guy who has not earned the benefit of the doubt like Brady, if Odell did a documentary of his season to try to return to the top of the league. But I feel like a lot of people would. I do not have a problem with Tom documenting it. But I feel like there's giving a guy a benefit of the doubt. And then there's
earned it.
Of course. Mm. And then there's changing the rules entirely. And fair or not, the type of things that Brady has done this offseason is the type of thing typically guys get criticized for. I don't criticize anybody for these types of things, which is why I'm not criticizing Tom. But I'm acknowledging that it's different. To act like it's not different for Brady to be publicly opining, even cutting a Super Bowl commercial about where he's going to play next, to act like that is not different from what we have always seen from them is just false.
Because he's been in the Super Bowl.
Okay, Coach,
like,
this is
like year after year. He has time, and he did one commercial. It's like...
I got no problem with him doing the commercial. It's different. And the idea that because he would have done it last year. He had plenty of off-season time last year. He is right now, can we just call it what it is? He is exerting maximum pressure on the Patriots.
That's what he's doing. He's trying to gain leverage.
Exactly.
But the other thing, though, Nick. But
that's fine. But that's what he's doing. It's not random. The premise of the Hulu commercial wasn't random. Him accepting that question
calculated.
On Instagram. And it's all calculated. That's fine.
Do you
fine.
Think that's maximum pressure? You don't think he could turn up the pressure? You think one Instagram post and one commercial is maximum pressure?
Well, I think
maybe it's also getting fans on this side.
He could turn this up a lot more if he wanted to.
Good are the Miami Heat? Well, they're a little bit better today after getting Andre Iguodala from the Grizzlies last night. The 36-year-old former NBA Finals MVP goes to Miami with a 2-year, $30 million extension. There are also reports that the trade could land Danilo Gallinari with the Heat before today's deadline. So, Nick, are the Heat legit contenders in the East after this move?
Well, if this move also culminates with Gallinari, I think they are the second best team in the conference. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think anyone in the East is going to be able to compete with Milwaukee. So defying if contender is, can you make the conference finals? 100%. Absolutely. They should be able to. They're right now fourth in the standings. They should be able to tick up to that 2-3 line so they avoid Milwaukee in round two. And things happen. Guys get hurt. Guys get tight. There are things to where you now look at Miami and say, man, Pat bleeping Riley, America. This guy had a good playing career. Was far better as a head coach, Hall of Fame coaching career, and I would argue Mannix has been even better as an executive than he was as a head coach. I don't know how they just all of a sudden, seemingly with no assets, get Jimmy Butler. And now all of a sudden, they might not only get Iggy, who I thought, maybe you tell me you were hearing different things, I thought he was definitely going to one of the two LA teams, but now also might get Gallinari. They already go 10 deep. I don't think their starting lineup is overwhelming, but their second lineup might be as good as their starting lineup. It's just a wildly impressive job of team building and culture building by Riley and Spo.
Yeah, a couple things. Throw in Andy Ellsberg, who's the GM down in Miami, who is like the cap master and made all this stuff work.
Has the job I want.
In the what we know department, right? We know that Iguodala is headed to Miami. He helps. Jimmy Butler has been taxed a lot this season. Iguodala is the kind of guy that defensively he's going to be able to step in and guard twos and threes and be that type of player, taking some of the pressure off some of the other guys on the roster. So assuming that he can get back into game shape, which, by the way, I'd still like to see at this point. He's been off since last June. Let's see how long it takes him to get back into shape. But assuming he can get back into game shape, that's a significant upgrade. They are not on Milwaukee's level, though, to your point, unless they add Gallinari. Gallinari is terrific. He is a 20-point-per-game scorer who can shoot the three, who can score various ways. He takes pressure offensively off of Jimmy Butler. Now, I've heard mixed things in the last 12 hours about whether or not that deal goes through. The Thunder are notoriously tough to deal with, but they are motivated to deal Gallinari, who is not part of their long-term future. So if they get Gallinari, I think they can compete with Milwaukee.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I was going to follow up on.
Compete
so you
with.
Think that if they get Gallinari, that they could, let's just assume full health for both sides, that could be a series that we're seeing a game six of, and you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think you could see a game six. I just think Bam Adebayo is great, a defensive player. Eric Spoelstra, excellent coach. He'll find different ways to kind of attack Giannis, maybe force him to be a perimeter shooter. And what worries me about Milwaukee, and when you talk to people in the Bucks organization, it worries them too, Eric Bledsoe. Eric Bledsoe remains somewhat of a concern because the last two postseasons, he has struggled at various points. Against Boston 2 years ago, he really struggled. The conference finals last year, he struggled. This year, there is no Malcolm Brogdon safety net. It's Eric Bledsoe and George Hill, who's been good, but it's Eric Bledsoe who needs to step up and play. If he struggles again, it opens the door.
And one last very quick point. Listen, Iguodala just turned 36, hasn't played basketball a year. He was playing limited minutes last year, but what he instantly adds is top of the league level maturity and playoff experience. And as good as this Heat team has been in the regular season, they haven't been very good on the road, which I think speaks to the lack of maturity. And once the postseason comes along, Kendrick Dunn, Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero have never played a big game in their respect or a real big game in their respective careers. Iggy will take some of the pressure off them in that regard.
No matter what happens over the next 12 hours, the big winner at the trade deadline is Andre Iguodala. He played golf for 6 months and now has a 2 year $30 million
extension.
That's what I'm saying.
Got to Miami, no state tax, an extension. Unbelievable.
Life is good for Iggy right now. The battle for bragging rights out in L.A. is heating up ahead of today's trade deadline. Lakers and Clippers reportedly in an arms race to steal away Knicks forward Marcus Morris. Morris is averaging just under 20 points per game this season. So, Maddox, which team needs that final piece a little bit more, the Lakers or the Clippers?
I wouldn't say either team needs that piece. And while I do believe that Marcus Morris will go to one of those two teams, I don't know that he tilts the balance one way or the other. The Clippers, if you're looking at their weaknesses, they need somebody in that front court. They need rebounding help, and Marcus Morris really isn't that guy. The Lakers, they could use more shooting, maybe help with the point guard position. Marcus Morris really isn't that guy. But Morris, if you're the Clippers, you can't let Marcus Morris get away. You have got a contract to deal in Mo Harkless.
And
you
Mo
have,
Harkless is not playing well.
Not playing. Like, not a factor. You can trade your first round pick this year, and after that, you can't trade it till like we colonize Mars. Yeah. Like it's going to be forever until you can trade a first round draft because of other deals that they've made. You've got to go out and use that capital to get Marcus Morris because he can play the three and the four. He is a 40%+ 3-point shooter. He is a guy that helps you, and you can't let that guy go across the hall to the LA Clippers. So while I think there are other shoes to drop, you've got buyout market for a big man for the Clippers. I think Darren Collison's a guy to watch in L.A. with the Lakers. I think Morris is the guy that, to answer that question, is the guy that the Clippers can't let get away.
Go ahead, Jenna. The follow-up I was going to have, though, is this. I understand the blocking move of we don't necessarily need Marcus Morris if we're the Clippers, but we don't want the Lakers to get him. Here, the reason my answer is who needs to add a piece more, it's very obvious. To me, it's the Clippers, but the piece is not Marcus Morris. The Clippers need a rim protector. You cannot beat in consecutive series the Lakers and the Bucks with Montrezl Harrell as your starting center. You just can't. Now, maybe he'll be the starting center, but without someone...
Well, with Zubac, you might be able to beat him. Zubac is an excellent perimeter defender.
Absolutely. For his size, he's a good perimeter defender.
Pick and roll defense is there.
You need a rim protector to stop Giannis and LeBron flatly. The reason I don't think the Lakers have a desperate need... Listen, would they like to add shooting? Yes. Every team in the league doesn't have enough shooting, right? Everyone would like to add shooting. And I think Collison would be a great fit for them. He was a guy I wanted them to go after this summer before Collison shockingly retired and seemingly left maybe a $30 million multi...
$50 million, probably. Yeah. The Ricky Rubio number was probably
a three-year, $48 million contract, something like that on the table. I can't believe he did it to this day. But... what the Lakers really, what their actual need is ball handling, another playmaker. I mean, come the playoffs, LeBron going to be playing 42 minutes a game. He's going to handle that for you. And this idea of, well, what if LeBron can't? Well, if LeBron can't, you're screwed. The Lakers' plan is very, very simple. Trust the greatest player ever to continue to play at that level. Anything less than that, they will lose, right? So I don't look at the Lakers having a massive need. I look at the Clippers and I say right now, there's five guys on their roster, Mannix, I really trust. none of them are rim protectors, and a few of them are designated hitters. Like Lou Williams is a one-way player. Patrick Beverley, even though he's shooting better this year, is a one-way player. And Trez is a one-way player. They need a big. And by big, I don't mean a post player. I mean I don't mean a four. I mean a five. And that's the part for me that I don't understand. I don't understand why they couldn't have gotten Capella because the Rockets weren't going to trade him in conference.
The guy that you're talking about that they should, I don't think he's available, but is Aaron Baines. Baines in Phoenix would be an ideal fit in that situation. He is a screen setter. He is a rim protector. He is a rebounder. He plays great on-ball defense.
Smells bad. Yeah, the whole nine. Everything you want from a big.
The sense I get is that Phoenix wants to re-sign him next summer. That's why he's not available. But if you can extract Aaron Baines, that would be the guy. Right now, I think they're looking at Marcus Morris, but Aaron Baines is exactly who you're talking about.
And that's the need for them. Like I know people think I'm too far down on the Clippers. They have a hole on their roster.
So for the Lakers, it's a want. For the Clippers, it's a need.
Perfect, Jenna. Exactly right. And for the Lakers, I also don't know for Marcus Morris. Like the part of the addition for the Lakers is it removes Kuzma. Listen, you and I have talked about this on your great podcast and one of your many media platforms. Kuzma needs to grow the hell up immediately. Kuzma, it's tough. Guys who haven't been paid, it's tough. Guys who haven't been in these winning situations, it's tough. People say LeBron wants to play with older guys. LeBron wants to play with guys who are more worried about what's right for the team than for themselves. But that is incredibly difficult if you haven't been paid yet. And Kuzma, whether it's his trainer popping off online or him continually blowing 3-on-1 fast breaks because he's the one who wants the layup instead of making the right pass, that is not a winning formula. And so one day he might be ready for this. Right now, he's not exhibited that. So if you ship him out and bring in a true pro in Marcus Morris and a legitimate tough guy, I do think that helps the Lakers in a substantial way.
Back here with Chris Mannix, we're talking Zion Williamson, the 19-year-old Pelicans phenom coming off his worst career performance Tuesday night. And to make matters worse, he suffered a right toe sprain that could hamper him tonight against the Bulls. Keep in mind, Zion missed the first 3 months of the season coming off knee surgery. Kind of begs the question, Nick, you starting to worry that Zion won't be able to hold up for an entire season?
No, and before the show, we, you know, our wonderful production staff puts together our list of topics, and I looked at this one curiously because, listen, it's a toe injury that's not even as bad as they thought it was going to be. People are trying to speak an injury concern into existence with Zion because at Duke we saw his shoe blow out and he dealt with that there. That was a freak happening. And then a real thing, the knee injury before the season that slowed his rookie season down and cost him the first half of the year. But this toe injury is the regular wear and tear of an NBA year. It's not even going to keep him out for a game. Go ahead, Jenna.
The regular year has only been like 7 or 8 games, though.
Yeah, but he's not going to. But let's see if he has another actual injury to me before I'm concerned about it. Everyone feels like his body shouldn't be able to handle his weight.
Right.
But why? Why? People, I would imagine, thought the same thing about LeBron. And he ended up being the most durable athlete we've seen in this league, this side of Karl Malone, maybe ever. Karl Malone, by the way, another guy who it's like, really? Can his body handle it? Those are the two most durable players we've ever seen. Now, Karl Malone wasn't as explosive as Zion. LeBron obviously was nearly as explosive as Zion. The reason to me, Mannix, this is a topic, is because there's so little parts of his game to pick at. Like, how do you have a polarizing opinion on Zion? He seems incredibly likable. He's a freak athlete. He was awesome at Duke. He's been great so far in his career. So how do you have a discussion about him? It's finding what could be a problem. At least that's how I see it.
Yeah, look, the toe injury is not an issue. Stuff like that comes up. Him playing poorly against Milwaukee is not an issue because that's the number one defense in the NBA. Going up against a guy who's in contention for the defensive player of the year, Giannis. I mean, that's welcome to the NBA the hard way. The counter argument, I don't disagree with you, but the counter argument I'd make to the Zion, are we sort of willing it into existence, is Blake Griffin, right? Blake Griffin's a guy that played with great explosiveness, who is kind of top heavy with some of that bulk. Went through knee injuries multiple times, dealing with one right now. So I think Zion's going to have to slim down this offseason to take some of the strain off that lower body because we've never seen a player like him. We've never seen a player that plays with that type of spring who is weighing, who's pushing close to 300 pounds. It just, they don't exist. And Blake's out there kind of as this maybe example of a guy that, you know, could be the pattern, a copy for Zion.
Or is there something to maybe developing and honing the outside shot a little bit more so it takes less pressure off whatever game you might have in the post, the wear and tear that might
cause? That'll happen eventually. Yeah. But that is, to me, those are two separate discussions. The guy, if he never improves, if he never gets better, is an all-star for a decade. Right now this year, the Pelicans, when he's not on the court, they're outscored by the opposition by around 4 points per 100 possessions. When he's on this court, they're outscoring the opposition by 10. By 10 points per 100 possessions. That's a superstar level impact immediately. As raw as he is, as young as he is, as basketball immature, if you will, not actually immature, as he is. And the Blake thing, you're absolutely right, but Blake's also dealt with some upper body injuries, right? And it does make you wonder, is Blake just a bit of a brittle guy?
You're right. It's just the one example that's out there of a guy that plays with the type of spring and lands with that kind of force at the power forward position.
And, no, it's a great example. And because Blake was his, I think, easiest comp coming out of Duke, right, where it's like, and it's one of the reasons why I was so bullish on his abilities rookie season, that Blake was a 20-10 guy immediately. Why could Zion not be that? Zion's been everything we imagined he could be. Instantly come in, be a plus help side defender, and unless you're playing the best defense in basketball, no one can stop him getting to the rim, Mannix.
No, they can't. But to spin it forward a little bit, like the Lakers won the Anthony Davis deal because they got Anthony Davis, but in the short sample size where we've watched Zion play with Lonzo Ball and Brandon Ingram, that's a team that's going to compete for a very long time. Like, Lonzo seems to have already developed chemistry with Zion, you know, playing in the up-tempo offense. Brandon Ingram, an all-star this year for the first time. That is going to be a team because they'll sign all these guys. Ingram, they're going to be comfortable paying this offseason. That's going to be a team to watch for the next foreseeable future.
The guy going into the game against Milwaukee was shooting 67% at the rim, getting 10 field goal attempts a game at the rim. Against Milwaukee, he got 15 field goal attempts at the rim. He just couldn't finish them because, as you mentioned, that team defense and Giannis going to end up like LeBron. Could have won a couple Defensive Player of the Year awards and ends up winning maybe none because people look at the offensive numbers and have it take away from what he was doing defensively. I have no concern about Zion. None.
And Jenna, to your point about the three-point shooting, it's remarkable that he's already shooting close to a little over 40% from three. Now, it's not a big sample size.
And it's all from that first game.
Right.
That first game going forward.
It took Blake Griffin like a decade to become a three-point shooter. A lot of guys take, you know, Giannis still isn't even there yet.
Ben Simmons, 104 years.
Ben Simmons, we're still waiting at this point for that to happen. But it took, the fact that he's comfortable taking shots from out there right now
is a great
sign. I think portends well for the future,
All right. Not only did Tom Brady have to watch the Super Bowl from the sidelines this year, I love you, Nick.
Yeah.
Tom Brady had to watch his former backup, Jimmy Garoppolo, while Brady's still deciding where he should take his talents next season. A USA Today column is suggesting the Niners replace Jimmy G with his mentor in Tom Brady. Nick, what do you think? You agree with that? Is there any merit to that?
Oh, there's merit to it, I suppose, because the Niners can get out of Jimmy Garoppolo's contract if they want to for only $4 million in dead money. And whatever Kyle Shanahan says moving forward, we know how he feels about Jimmy G. We know. After the Super Bowl, he was asked about his play. He said, I thought he was all right, which is about right. During the Super Bowl, we saw what he thinks about him at halftime, minute 44, three timeouts, chance to go take the lead. Nah, man, I'm going to go ahead and sit on this and then run the ball on first down, run the ball on second down, only take a shot downfield after the Chiefs call timeout and force your hand. With that said, they are not moving on from Jimmy Garoppolo this summer to go to a 43-year-old Tom Brady, who, for all my criticisms of Jimmy G, was not nearly as good as Jimmy G this year. Now, he was better at not turning the ball over, which is Garoppolo's biggest bugaboo, but no, I mean, is it fun to think about the Niners trading Jimmy Garoppolo back to New England for a second round pick and Brady going into Northern California where he's from on a team that is, I think right now, far better, well-rounded and with a great tight end, a good offensive line, all these things we say Brady needs. Yeah, but I don't think it would be an upgrade for the Niners, and the Niners got to be looking at this coach long term, and even if you're higher on Brady than I am right now, he's not a long term answer for anybody.
Well, what happened at the end of the half wasn't a function of Jimmy Garoppolo, it was a function of Patrick Mahomes and that respect that they had for them. So to say it's just about Jimmy at halftime, that's not true. In the second half, he was throwing the ball. He was 18 for 21. He was doing a lot of good things. They put their faith in him, and everybody's frustrated because they didn't run the ball more. So to say that he feels a certain way about Jimmy Garoppolo, I don't think that's a fair depiction of what happened or truly how he feels. Now, the idea of Tom going to San Francisco, the systems are as polar opposite as you can get. New England's system is based on maybe one motion, which really isn't a motion, it's truly a shift, to gather information. Everything is pre-snap information, primarily stationary, or one information gathering movement, where San Francisco is shift, motion, things change rapidly.
Play defensively. Action-based.
It's not even that part of it. It's just the pre-snap component. They don't fit. They don't fit what Tom does, and they don't fit what that system is. So the idea, it just doesn't work. It doesn't work.
Yeah, I hate the idea. I think you don't get much older, and you know that's a big jump from where Jimmy G is until where Tom Brady is.
15 years.
That's crazy. You don't do that, especially when your team made the Super Bowl. Jimmy G is a Super Bowl playing quarterback, a guy that, of course, he didn't win the Super Bowl, but he also played the best player in the NFL in Patrick Mahomes, one of the best coaches in the Hall of Fame.
He was out playing Patrick Mahomes for most of the game.
For a long time. And one of the best coaches, Andy Reid, certainly a Hall of Fame coach. But also, you got to think about this. Jimmy G certainly is older, but he's only had 26 starts in the NFL. And if I'm Kyle Shanahan, I'm saying he's still a very young quarterback as far as starting goes. And then you go out there, you make this team better. You make Jimmy G better. You don't trade. In this situation, when you lose a Super Bowl, you don't panic and start saying, oh, we need to start shuffling the cards. You try to make your team better.
Coach, there's one thing, though, I'm going to take major issue with what you said, which is what the faith Kyle Shanahan did or did not show in his quarterback at the end of that half. If you are so afraid of the other team's quarterback, then you have to go try to acquire points. They weren't leading. It was 10 to 10. The answer can't be we're so afraid of Patrick Mahomes in the second half when he has 30 minutes to score that we aren't going to try to score right now because we might give him 45 seconds at the end of that half.
They were in a position to score, right? There's the offensive pass interference, so they would have.
But that was only because.
Were they in a position to score?
Only because Andy Reid forced their hand. Coach, he let 40 seconds run off the clock, then they ran the ball, let another 40 run off the clock, ran the ball, and then Reid called timeout. They were going to the half.
You cannot be mad at him when we talk all
His
week.
His GM was mad at him.
Okay, he hired ahead. The GM. Let's relax on that. So you can't be mad at him because of his respect for Patrick Mahomes, and this happens all the time, where people think, oh, we're going to go get a quick score. Oh, we're going to change the momentum. You do change the momentum for the other team.
Yeah, if you
And then
don't...
your team going into halftime, instead of feeling really good about being at 10-10, is suddenly down 17-10 because you made an irresponsible decision against an explosive offense, and then we're sitting here going, I can't believe he gave Patrick Mahomes another
quick strike offense.
A quick strike.
It's only irresponsible if you don't trust your quarterback not to turn the ball over. The only way
that's not even about turning the ball over. It's about giving the other team an opportunity for the last shot. Why not play for the last shot? What's wrong
with
it?
They played for no shot, Coach. We can say because they ended up throwing it downfield, but we watched that game. There's a minute 44 left. They don't call timeout. They then on first down with a minute left, run the ball, use the whole play clock. On second down, run the ball again. They don't call timeout there. The Chiefs call timeout with 22 seconds left. They were going to play for no shot because he didn't believe in the quarterback.
And how would the Chiefs have felt If that offensive pass interference didn't
go through,
Andy
would have gotten killed.
And let's say they scored a touchdown or kicked a field goal, and that ends up being the difference in the game. Are you going to be sitting here going, you know, Andy Reid did a great thing. He tried to give Patrick Mahomes another shot, and he changed the whole momentum of the game in favor of the 49ers.
No, but what I will tell you is this. I apologize, Brian. What I will tell you is this. Andy Reid knows he's got a great quarterback. He wanted to roll the dice that my quarterback can do something with 20 seconds to go score. Kyle Shanahan said, can my quarterback with 100 seconds and two timeouts do something? Nope, don't trust him. That's what the action should
be. I think Coach is actually right. I think that what you say, if you're the 49ers, is that we held Andy Reid, Patrick Mahomes, to 10 points in the first half of a football game. If we can figure out a way to hold them to 10 points in the second half, we can outscore them in the second half. The one thing you couldn't account for if you are the San Francisco 49ers is that the Kansas City Chiefs was going to score 21 points in 6 minutes and 13 seconds in the fourth quarter. If you tell me that they score only 14, then at that point it's a different type of game. You have a chance to win it at the end.
But that's the whole reason for the thought process is because they can score 20 points.
That's the reason why you don't give them the ball back.
Yeah, you don't give them another opportunity to go score, you know, and change the whole momentum.
You want them to be more aggressive.
No, I know people will be surprised by this. Philosophically, when it comes to football, I actually agree with Coach the vast majority of the time. We talk on and off the air about kind of bigger picture football stuff, and I agree with you most of the time. This one, I categorically disagree with the philosophy. If you are up against a potent, dangerous, an offense that can score 21 points in 6 minutes, then every time you have the ball, you have to try to go acquire points. The whole Patriot methodology
but
of...
But you also have to try to keep them from getting opportunities to acquire points. Not only do you recognize your strengths, you recognize your opponent's strengths, and the idea of when you know the running rebels, you don't try to run with them. You got to try to shorten the game and put yourself in a position to win at the end.
Going into the game, the big thing that you want to do if you're the 49ers is limit their possessions. That's what you're trying to do at the end of the half. You're trying to limit their possessions.
And if you have faith your quarterback can get 2 first downs, you guarantee they're not getting the ball back anyway.
Hang on. So this Brady for Garoppolo, that's not happening?
I don't think it's happening.
Do you remember like a year ago when we brought that up at the beginning of the segment and then we didn't
this
get back
more
to it? I was so excited.
We all agreed
to hear.
It wasn't happening. This
I didn't
more
agree with you. I thought it would be great. Kyle Shanahan would love to have Tom Brady. Don't you think? Maybe?
No.
Okay. Well, we wrap that up. All right, moving on to the Eagles now. Their disappointing season was cut short with their wild card loss to the Seahawks. But their 27-year-old franchise quarterback Carson Wentz isn't wallowing in defeat, instead deciding to look to the future. Tweeting during Super Bowl Sunday, "Sights set on today being a work day for me next year." All right, Brian, you buying that Carson Wentz and the Eagles can make a Super Bowl run next season?
I think it's going to be tough. I think they have some holes to fill, but they have the components of Super Bowl teams. They have a good quarterback. They're going to have to fill some holes in the wide receiver position. But I think offensively, they started moving in the right direction. Last year, the last quarter of the season, Carson Wentz became a much better leader of that football team. He became a much better leader of men. When you take Alshon out of the picture, you take Nelson Aguilar out of the picture, he allowed those young guys and took those young guys that basically had no NFL experience to a playoff berth, was able to win the last 4 games of the season. The other thing they have to do offensively, they have to be much more creative. They just can't dink and dunk the way, throw the ball to the tight ends and try to find a way to win that way. They need some explosive plays down the field. And in order to get those explosive plays, they need downfield speed. They have to have some speed. Both of the teams that played in the Super Bowl and many of the teams that played in the playoffs have downfield speed. Right now, the Eagles don't have any speed downfield.
And I think the reality is when you're not in the Super Bowl, every day should be a work day for you. So go out and lift some weights or throw some balls or do whatever you need to do.
But, I love you so much.
But that being said, there's this element of again, we fire the offensive coordinator, right? It's got to be the coach's fault. It can't be anybody else's fault. So we get rid of him, even though there's an offensive head coach, and I'm sure he had a lot of input in it. So now we have a new system in play. Well, maybe it's not a new system, but there's going to be a new structure in place that he's going to have to get used to. And it's going to be interesting to see how much he continues to mature and grow, and whether or not during the course of this offseason and even into the start of the season, what the vibe is coming out of that locker room. Are they a unified group? Do they all support each other? And you saw that in Kansas City, and you saw that in San Francisco, where they were behind the, whatever you want to say about Jimmy Garoppolo, the guys were behind him, and yep, they supported him. And as much as your play is important, people believing in you is important as well.
But you still need the downfield speed. Yeah. Eagles were one of the slowest teams last year, and the two teams that made it to the Super Bowl were one of the fastest teams. You still need, I would imagine, your quarterback to play like he did that Super Bowl year when it was cut short for him with injury. Isn't that what those two things are, what you need going into the season? Well, right now, they don't have that speed.
And
they
I think to a degree they go hand in hand. Like, I think to Brian's point, Wentz will play better if he has more dynamic playmakers on the outside. I also think in Wentz's defense, granted the competition wasn't the greatest, when their backs were up against the wall the final 5 weeks of the season, he played his best football. It was 300 yards per game passing, a passer rating of nearly 100, 10-1 touchdown interception ratio as they went on that run at the end of the year. And the one game they lost in that run, I think it was to Miami, if I remember correctly, but they scored 32 points in that game. They didn't lose it because the offense didn't do enough. I do think this, though. Philly is not the team that won the Super Bowl. Coach talks about this all the time, but with Philadelphia, it is particularly true. That team had a dominant pass rush and a dominant offensive line. They had neither last year. To be totally candid, like, I don't know that that team is going to come back again. And they did just pay the quarterback, and so the ability to have all the pieces
around it. His salary cap number is actually fairly, I think it's only $18 million. So even though that number seemed big, and when we talk about it, it's big, $18 million versus
18 next year,
30
absolutely.
And 35 and 40 that we're talking about is actually small.
And by the way, if next year it's 18, that does mean a year or two down the road that bill will eventually come due. But they didn't overpay him. I think Wentz is right. If the going rate for league average is 28, then Wentz at 32 sounds about right. But I also think, and you alluded to it, Coach, I also think this is a year where we can really find out, all right, so let's see what exactly Doug Peterson is made of. He has last year he tried to go to every motivational ploy he had, and none of them really seemed to resonate with the team until the team was in win or go home situations where they were playing bad competition. The Giants twice, Washington, and then the big game of the year, the game of the year for them against Dallas, where they played well. And the question is, like, how good is Philly really? Are we going to look back on that Super Bowl and say, what a weird champion? Like that, beat the Patriots, go on this run, have a backup quarterback? Or are we going to look at that Super Bowl and say, okay, the weird year was last year as opposed to the championship
year? Don't forget how riddled they were with injuries last year. We came into last year saying how much depth they had. It didn't even matter. More than almost any team in the league, they were hurt top to bottom. Even Carson Wentz in that last game against Seattle went out with a concussion. But I mean, they were just really, really banged up. Doug Peterson had to do anything he could to motivate those guys.
Well, you also got to remember, going into the season, they were the top three, one of the top three oldest teams in the league. And all of those players, Jason Peters, Darren Sproles, missed significant time, weren't able to contribute as much. Indeed, Jason Peters came back and helped. But again, he's 37, 38 years old. It's just hard to compete on that level. They have to get much younger. They need that explosion downfield. But defensively, like you mentioned, Nick, they have to find a way to get much better and be able to get to the quarterback. The teams that win in this league have the ability to be explosive downfield offensively and to be able to get to the quarterback defensively.
And they haven't had corners, and both their corners, they do have Mills and Darby are free agents. So, like, even the Super Bowl year, the secondary wasn't great aside from Malcolm Jenkins. If the pass rush is lessened, you're in a really rough spot if you don't trust your back end.
Yeah, but to me, if you're tweeting out about what you're going to do next year, then it's your responsibility to make sure that you fixed all the things that you can control.
That's right.
To say the 76ers have been bad on the road this season would be like saying I like a good Seinfeld reference. Massive understatement. Philly's lost 10 of their last 12 on the road, and tonight they go up against the Bucks in Milwaukee. So with rumors of discord in the locker room, with guys struggling on the court, where does that leave the Sixers? Here's Joel Embiid.
I mean, do you feel like you have an identity at all right now?
No, we don't. Spacing is an issue. We sometimes we play fast, sometimes we play slow.
Does anybody need to stand up and call somebody out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's some stuff going on in our locker room, and we'll keep that internal. But we all know we need to be better. We need to step it up, and it's a great opportunity to do it tomorrow.
Ooh. What do you think, Mannix, about what Horford and Embiid had to say?
A lot of thoughts. I mean, Embiid, remarkably blunt in that, do we have an identity? No. Sometimes we play fast, sometimes we play slow. And I covered Al Horford for most of last season. He didn't say anything like that about the Celtics, who were very dysfunctional during the year last year. He was very measured with his comments. So you take that into account when you hear those words from Al Horford. This is a team that I think still has the ability to get it together because of how they defend. They can put together maybe the best defensive team in the conference, can put a chokehold on people on that end of the floor. But they have no identity whatsoever offensively. Now,
and they're not going to.
But I don't disagree with you, but the hope is that the guys they acquired, Alec Burks, Glenn Robinson, who played okay in Golden State, both these guys are pretty good perimeter shooters. Maybe they can solve some of their problems. But you have to look at it and say, all right, whose spot in the rotation are those guys taking? Are they going to play instead of Josh Richardson? Are you going to get Tybull's minutes? Because he's a good defender, too. It's tough to find a way for this team to get good enough offensively to compete with the Milwaukees, even the Bostons and Torontos in the Eastern Conference.
Isn't it time to just choose already between Embiid and Simmons?
Yes. Look, I think this season and the end result of this season, I think, is a referendum on this team. Because they can't do much this offseason. They're kind of landlocked. I think they got $120 million committed to like their top five guys. There's nothing they can do to really make this team different. So if you get beat in like the first round, which is not out of the realm of possibility, I think you have to break up this group, and I think Simmons will be the one to go.
Simmons would be the one to
I think
go,
so,
even
yeah.
though Embiid's the one I think that has far more
value. We disagree,
value.
But yeah.
We don't disagree on that, right?
More value
that Embiid has more value is on the trade market.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with you, by the way, that if I would not trade Joel Embiid. He is in a league where everyone's going pace and space and small. If he realizes his full potential, and unlike Simmons, he's at least realized 85% of his.
Right.
Simmons is hovering around 55, 60% of his. If he realizes that final 15%, he can be a league MVP. And for, 90% of your games, the other team has nobody to match up with him. Nobody. There's only a few teams that have somebody that could even passably match up against him. The reason I mentioned the Embiid Harden thing is it's just two of your best eight players in basketball, both of whose teams might be like, you know what I mean? How can we get fair value and how can we switch things up? But to the bigger picture here, there's one name you didn't mention that I think should be mentioned, and it's Brett Brown. I was talking with our great statistician, Dusty's a Sixers fan, and he made this point before the show, and I think it's a smart one, and I'd love to steal it from him, but it's his, so I'll give him credit. We were talking about the Heat. If you flip-flop Brett Brown and Eric Spoelstra, what do the Heat look like, and what are the, more importantly, what do the Sixers look like with I think Eric Spoelstra is a great coach. I think he's one of the five best coaches in basketball. Brett did an awesome job through the process, navigating through it, not have it wear him down mentally, keeping the players, when they weren't really even trying to win games, engaged.
A survivor.
And by the way, sometimes you have a coach who is the right guy to get you from A to B, but that does not mean he's ready to get you from B to championship. And it would appear we have multiple playoff series where it looks like he gets outcoached against the better coaches in basketball, whether it's Nick Nurse, we saw that happen, whether it's your guy Brad Stevens in Boston, and now his inability to cut through to the team, even on the defensive end. Because you said they can be one of the best defensive teams in basketball. With this lineup, with this roster, they should be the number one defense by certainly top two defense along with Milwaukee, and given that the Clippers haven't had their full roster all year, they're a good defense. They should be a dominant defense. I put that on coaching, at least partially, and figure out a way to get through to your best players. Like that, Embiid and Simmons have a maturity problem. And if you can't time warp them to where they're 32 years old and know what they need to know, that's the coach's job, man.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I'll go to my guy, LeBron. He had a bit of a maturity problem his first stint in Cleveland. And guess what happened? He called it going to college,
yep.
But he went to a form of boot camp with Pat Riley and Eric Spoelstra and became a grown-ass man.
It's time for Joel Embiid and or Ben Simmons to have a similar evolution, and I'm just not seeing it. And that, to me, is about what those comments are about from Horford, who is a grown-ass man and knows what you need to be in this league.
I do think that a lot of those, the undertone of those comments, though, are directed at Simmons, because it's not the first time that these guys have said as much. I mean, Joel Embiid has sort of passive-aggressively said guys need to step out of their comfort zone, and that is directed at Ben Simmons. Brett Brown and Elton Brand have come out and said, please shoot, Ben. Please, if you don't shoot in the regular season, we're not going to be successful in the playoffs. So I think that's a big issue. But to your point about Brett Brown, you're right. He has been outcoached in the playoffs. Defensively, they should be a top two team in the NBA. But at some point offensively, you've got to look at what the groceries are here. You lose J.J. Redick in the offseason, the number two three-point shooter in the league, and don't replace him with anyone outside of Matias Thybulle, a rookie, a defensive-minded player. What are you going to do? Ben Simmons still won't shoot. What are you going to do? Josh Richardson, not a great perimeter shooter. What are you going to do? They just don't have the pieces to be a good perimeter shooting team. I don't care how good you are defensively. You're not a championship team if you can't make shots from the three-point line.
But yet, despite this, we had high expectations for the Sixers coming into this season. You bring in Al Horford, who's supposed to be that veteran voice in the locker room and kind of calm things down. And yet, here we are with the same problems you had last season.
Seed. Shockingly bad on the road.
And that's immaturity. And by the way, as was reported yesterday, you get annihilated by Miami. You spend the night in Miami hanging out. I'm not one to criticize guys for enjoying.
Yeah, that's off-brand for you.
Yeah, because, listen. So when I was in Houston a few weeks ago, watched the Lakers-Houston game. Lakers won that game. They had already planned, I think, to stay over in Houston. They played well. And as it turned out, the whole team went out together to one of Houston's night spots, right? Not one of Houston's famous night spots that is a gentleman's spot, but just a regular club. You know what? Playing well. You've earned it. Mm-hmm. You won the game. When you're the Sixers and you haven't had a good road trip all year, pre-planning, hey guys, after the game, a party in Miami, it's just bad optics, to say the least, and it might speak to, I think, part of Horford's frustration. Because I don't think Al Horford's out there, you know what I mean? Out there partying in Miami. It's just a lot of things with the Sixers team. They have enough raw talent that they should be after Milwaukee and the two LA teams, because I'm going to include the Clippers because everyone else is but me, it seemingly, they should be the next team.
Yeah.
They should. If I were to tell you no team from LA or Milwaukee win the title, who wins the title going into this year, the answer should have been Philly. And right now you're looking up at the standings at Indy? At Indy?
One thing I would just say quickly is that the Sixers season ended on a basketball bouncing four times on the rim from Kawhi Leonard. That ball bounces a different way. Maybe the Sixers are in the finals. Yep. And because of that, they broke up that team. They let Jimmy Butler walk. They let J.J. Redick walk. They brought in Al Horford ostensibly to compete with Milwaukee because of their size. That's something I think that Elton Brand and the front office has to answer for.
It's a great
they
point.
Broke up a good team based on a bouncing ball on the rim that would have cost them the game.
Sliding doors, it's what we always say. Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern.